As I sometimes do, I am doing kind of a two-part series. And last week, I began to speak a little bit about how we bring these Buddhist teachings and practices of awareness to fear. And I'd like to continue that tonight. And just to begin by saying, one of my favorite descriptions of a teacher on the path, Munindraji, when he responded to the question, well, what's really the purpose of all this practice we do? And his response was to live the life fully. He said, we do this to live the life fully. And when I reflect, you know, it really seems that in a very deep way, when we're suffering, it's because there's some grief, some sense that we're not really showing up. We're not, as Thich Nhat Hanh said, making our appointment with life. That we're losing precious moments, or when we're, or the grief is about losing this body or this mind or another person. But it's when we feel like in some way we're not fully inhabiting our lives. And we each know that I've talked a lot about how the Buddha described this as we go into a trance. And this is our conditioning. We go into a trance whereby we forget presence and get preoccupied by a sense of a separate self that's in trouble or needs to accomplish something. We get caught in our thoughts about worrying and planning about what's going to happen. And very busy. We seem to be running away from the present moment. We're running towards something else or away from what's happening. That's the trance. Mahatma Gandhi said there's more to life than simply increasing its speed. You know? And I bring that in because when we get afraid, we tend to either, some of us freeze, but most of us speed up. Have you noticed how when there's anxiety, the mind starts just turning at twice the rate, trying to figure out and anticipate and plan, and the body tenses and gets real activated? So last week I talked about what's called the body of fear. You know, what happens when we get caught? And physically, we're somewhat familiar with it. There's a kind of armor that develops over the years. Very young children are usually fairly relaxed, but as the fear keeps arising, the body tenses to try to control things. And the shoulders go up and forward, and kind of the back hunches over, the belly gets tightened, there's a real armoring in the belly. Sometimes a clenching of the jaw, the brow gets tight, we kind of lock in, and it becomes a kind of permanent armor. And then we know that our minds get into the habit of obsessing. We're very addicted to thought. And it's much of the time it's fear-driven. It's interesting to check when you find your mind spinning. What's the mood of the body and the heart underneath? The body of fear usually produces an agitated, spinning, obsessing mind. And then, of course, behaviorally, we each have our own set of behaviors. When we're living in the body of fear, we usually have behaviors that are to try to make us feel more safe and calm, and they usually are to distract us, to occupy us, to numb us. Often, when we're caught in the body of fear, one of the main ways it's expressed is this inability to be close with others. Because hand in hand with the body of fear is a sense of I'm wrong, I'm bad, I'm not going to be lovable. So we either, in avoiding intimacy, we either pull away or often we go on the attack. There's a lot of judgment that comes out of the body of fear. Again, I invite you, when you're caught in judging, to check in. The body, usually our heart is not feeling happy and at peace when we're judging. So there's a kind of that attack mode. I like Rita Rudner's, one of my favorites. She puts it this way. She says, my grandmother seemed like a very tough woman. She buried three husbands. Two of them were just napping. So I mentioned last week that the body of fear comes out of an evolutionary response to danger and for survival. I mean, we wouldn't make it if we didn't have fear. We'd be, as I mentioned last week, would be brain dead if there were no fear. So it appropriately gives us the fight or flight response. But what happens is that we get locked into a sustained fight flight response. Many of us are way over-amped. It's not just helping us survive. We lock into a biochemistry of fight or flight. And the biochemistry of fear is incompatible with loving. It's not that the love's gone, but we can't really have access to it when we're afraid. It's incompatible with creativity. You know, it's in some very basic ways, it's incompatible with any sense of wonder or joy. It's got a very defined purpose to get us to run, to freeze, or to fight. So this is trance. This is when our reality narrows and we get locked into a perception of something's wrong. And our body and our emotions and our thoughts and our behaviors are all living out of that. I shared last spring a story that I thought really described the nature of fear, which is really how we, in any moment of fear, there's a sense something is about to crash. Something's going to go terribly wrong. And I thought I'd share it again because it's so much fun. And it was told by an English monk who described another guy in his monastery who had very bad teeth. Some of you remember this? And he found a dentist. This was when this monk lived in Australia for a while. He found a dentist who would extract his teeth without anesthetics. And he doesn't find that a problem. But he decided to go one step better and do it himself. So here's the story. We saw him outside the monastery workshop holding a freshly pulled tooth smeared with blood in the claws of an ordinary pair of pliers. It was no problem. He cleaned the pliers of blood before he returned them to the workshop. I asked him how he had managed to do such a thing. What he said exemplifies why fear is the major ingredient of all suffering and pain. When I decided to pull out my own tooth, it was such a hassle going all the way to Perth to the dentist, that didn't hurt. When I decided, it didn't hurt. When I walked to the workshop, that didn't hurt. When I picked up the pair of pliers, that didn't hurt. When I wiggled the pliers and pulled, it did hurt then, but only for a couple of seconds. Once the tooth was out, it didn't hurt much at all. There was only 5 seconds of actual pain, that's all. Now you, my reader, probably grimaced when you read this true story. Because of fear, you probably felt more pain than he did. And if you tried the same feat, it would probably hurt terribly, even before you reached the workshop to get the pliers. Anticipation, fear, is the major ingredient of pain. Isn't it true? I mean, how many moments of our life are we living in a movie about what is to come? We're on our way to that, and that is creating an inner kind of stress, a kind of an angst. That in some way we won't come through, we'll fail, something will go terribly wrong. So let's explore how we wake up out of this trance. How we begin to, in a way I think of it as reclaim the moments of our life. So they're really not in that kind of prison where the body's tight, the mind is busy, and we're missing out on a day like today, right? And I want to say again that freedom from fear doesn't mean that sometimes the grip or the clutch of being afraid isn't in our body or that we don't have any worry thoughts. Freedom from fear means that our sense of who we are, our sense of our life, is not taken over. That we can move through our day and arrive in the moments, not be squeezed and kind of toppling into the next moment because we're trying to take care of or anticipate what can go wrong. Now, the Buddha often talked about the path to this freedom as taking refuge. And many of you are familiar with that that language. And what it means is really finding what's safe. That we awaken from the trance of fear by realizing and trusting what's safe. And when we talk about true refuge, it means it's truly safe. But as we know, we can't find true refuge from dying, right? Like, that's going to happen anyway. So there's no safety from dying. There's no protection against that. Or from aging, or any of the real losses. One Zen teacher said that under all fear, there's the sense of the fragility of life. All our fears are about protecting our existence, protecting against loss of connectedness, of aliveness. So how do we deal with that? If that's our fear, and there's really no safety. So I like the way Steve Wright put it. He sometimes has pithy little statements. He says, I was hitchhiking the other day, and a hearse stopped. I said, no thanks, I'm not going that far. What we usually do, so here's the deal. We're afraid we're going to die. The separate self is afraid of losing its existence. Okay, and because there's no real safety against that, we take what's called false refuge, which many of you are familiar with here. Most of us spend a lot of time taking a false refuge, trying to in some way protect ourselves against the inevitable. We latch on to how much we can achieve and feel like, you know, I'm a worthwhile person. Or we take refuge in trying to control others around us to make us feel more on top of things. Or for so many, that angst is soothed by food, too much of it. Sleep, too much of it. Drugs, too much of it. So the earmarks of false refuge, if you want to check and say, okay, am I taking a false refuge? One is that it's temporary. It never really works. It can't. Because it never really takes away the basic threat, which is that we're going to die. We're going to lose things. We're going to lose what we love. So that's one. It's that it's never enough. There's always that undercurrent. No matter how much we use the food or how much we accomplish or whatever, it's still there. And the second sign of false refuge is that it takes a huge amount of our ongoing attention and energy. We keep having to prop ourselves up. So if we take false refuge trying to prove ourselves to others, or then we have to keep reproving. Or if it's a substance, we need another fix. I think you get the notion. So these are false refuges. They don't work. It's like Lily Tomlin said. She says, the trouble with being in the rat race, or with beating the rat race, is that even if you win, you're still a rat. I think that's the way she said it. I'm not exactly sure if that was the way she said it. Anybody know that one? Anyway, it's something like that. So false refuge. And I've talked a lot about false refuge. The Buddha talked about all the different ways that we get attached to things, to substitutes. We want a deep sense of happiness and peace, and we get fixed on substitutes. It's like putting the ladder up against the wall and climbing to find out we put it on against the wrong wall. You know, we climb all the way up. None of these works. Okay, so what does it mean to take true refuge? And as we'll explore tonight, the only refuge in the face of what we're really afraid of is unconditional presence. The only refuge. The only way we can find a sense of safety, space, peace, in the face of the inevitability of loss, which is what our bodies are tensed up about, is unconditional presence. Okay? So just to speak a little more, some of you might remember there's this equation, which is pain or fear times resistance equals suffering. That to the extent that the fear comes up and we resist it, to that extent we suffer. And Kafka said, you can hold back from the suffering of the world, from the shadow deities, from the fear in your own heart. You can hold back from that. You have free permission to do so, and it is in accordance with your nature. But perhaps this very holding back is the one suffering you could have avoided. So what do we mean by not holding back? And we'll start with, what's the attitude we can, if we're not going to hold back from the fear, if we look at the attitude that really is helpful, is to think of the fear as a kind of vulnerability in us, like our child, an inner child, but a vulnerability that has felt pushed away or judged or controlled or shamed for many decades for many of us. And then if you ask that kind of young place in us, that scared place, what do you most want? If you inquire, what do you most want from me? So this is something I invite you to do when you're in your own process. If you're feeling scared and you sense that vulnerability is there and you ask that part of you, what do you want from me? I've done this many rounds with many people. There's a basic common denominator people come to when you ask that fear, what do you want from me? And that common denominator is, I want to be recognized and accepted. That part of us wants to be recognized and accepted. And that's what children all want. You know, I sometimes ask, you know, a very, very young child, what's most important to a very young child? And it's to be seen, to be really seen for who they are, he or she is, and to be accepted, cared about, appreciated for that. And these are, in Buddhism, are called the two wings, you know, seeing and loving. And I think of meditation as spiritual reparenting. That, you know, the fears in us for years have been either ignored or suppressed or depressed or, you know, pressed down in some way. We've covered them over. And that they, in order to free ourselves from fear, like some part of our being that's really been pushed away, we need to include, to reparent with clear seeing and with love. One of the metaphors recently that I found really describes what's happened to a lot of us, I think, is understanding how spores form, and that you see it in the plant kingdom, that there are times when that are really harsh, and what's needed for a plant to bloom can't be found. The conditions aren't right, so certain plants become spores. And these plants kind of dampen down and wall off their life force in order to survive. And it's a really effective strategy. They couldn't make it in those conditions. And spores are found in mummies. You know, they've been thousands of years. And then they've unfolded, when given the right conditions, they've unfolded into plants. So the metaphor. So when children are judged, are not, are rejected, or fear rejection, okay, there's a kind of a message that be different or you won't be approved and loved, you know, and that brings up a lot of fear. They form spores. They wall off the vulnerable parts, the unloved parts of themselves. They wall them off. They wall off the vulnerability. And it's survival. It's to survive. Parts of our being get shut down. And it's frozen life energy. And now, in the plant kingdom, plant spores are opportunists. Like when the life force is waiting in there and it's scanning in the environment for the first opportunity to bloom. Well, we get so in the habit, this kind of spore-like parts of us, we are so believing our story that we're not lovable, that things aren't going to work out, that we sometimes miss the opportunity. So that's why we come to spiritual practice, to begin to offer to our inner life the conditions needed to free ourselves. So what's needed for these kind of cased off parts of us, the walled off fears and vulnerability, what's needed? These two wings. Recognizing them. Okay, I see. This is fear. and a deep quality of allowing. And when I say allowing, I mean a kind of allowing that has heart, a deep allowing. In the mythology of the Buddha, many of you know he sat under the Bodhi tree, the tree of awakening, and Mara, the forces of Mara, attacked. And this was greed, hatred, delusion, fear, fear, fear. And he met those spears and arrows and with these two qualities I'm talking about. He met them with to see what was true and hold with love. And that's what freedom. But as the story goes, Mara, which is the god of greed, hatred, and delusion, reappeared again and again and again through the Buddha's life. It's not like he just vanished, right? And so it is with us, that we can awaken and experience a lot of freedom around some of these energies, and then they come up again. And the two, and the most notable response the Buddha had, and it's this, I love this part of the mythology, is through the years he'd be teaching, and Mara would make his, you know, come on stage, so to speak, and Buddha's attendant, Ananda, also his cousin, would see Mara and go, "Oh no, the evil one is here," you know, like making the cross, and he'd say, "What shall we do?" He'd talk to the Buddha, say, "What should we do, holy sir? What should we do?" And the Buddha said, you know, kind of calm down. And his two responses to Mara, two responses. The first one, "I see you, Mara." Okay, that's the wing of clear seeing. And the second one was, he invited him to tea. Okay, that's the second wing. You know, that's like inviting what's here with our heart. So for the rest of the evening, we're going to explore how those two wings can spiral us into the quality of presence that's liberating. To see what's true in the moment, what is happening right now. You can sense that right here, the power of the question. What is happening inside me right now? And then the second, can we meet this with genuine friendliness, kindness, heart? Now, for some, there's an acronym that's helpful in exploring this with fear. And I'm going to give you the acronym, and you can toss it aside if you find it's not useful. But the acronym for what this process in having the spore, the walled-off fear, the frozen energy released and freed, is RAIN. And the way it goes is R is recognition. I see you, Mara. I see this fear. And A is allowing. It's like, okay, come on in. I invite you to tea. And I is a kind of a deepening investigation where you keep on noticing and allowing and noticing and allowing and really becoming intimate with the actual experience. So R, RAIN, of the RAIN is recognize. A is allow. I is investigate, a deepening of recognizing and allowing. And N means not personal. R could be natural awareness, that when you spiral in this kind of presence, you come to your naturalness, to that space. And it's described this way. If you know you're the ocean, you won't be afraid of the waves. That as you bring presence to what's here, you discover a kind of naturalness, a vastness of presence that's bigger than the fear. So I'll give you an example of somebody I worked with rather recently and how she used RAIN, and then I'll give you a chance to try it out, okay? And again, the acronym's not as important as just these two basic wings of recognizing what's happening and allowing that, finding the space and the heart for what's here. It's called learning to stay. Now, in this example I want to give you... Oh, I forgot a couple of things I was going to mention. One is Thoreau has a quote that says, "If a dog runs at you, whistle for it." That's one. Which is again this idea that rather than, oh my God, fear, Mara is here, you know, evil, evil, it's like, okay, welcoming what's here. Well, as, you know, you remember Rumi welcoming the guests? Okay, that's one. And then one Zen master was asked how he related with fear, and his response, I agree, I agree. Same idea, right? Okay, so I kind of put that out there. Okay, so it's actually a woman from our community here who was in her marriage finding that she was hitting a lot of fear. She would end up withdrawing and getting passive aggressive because she was just, her husband's anger really got her afraid. And she grew up with an emotionally abusive father who overdrank, and so he was unpredictable, and she would never know when he would make her feel like she had done something wrong. She'd stepped over some unknown line or something. And so on some level she felt like she had married her father and that her husband's anger and judgment and so on kept her on guard, and like in any moment she was going to run into that. And so she came to a lot of these classes and so on, and was working with it. And she, sometimes the fear was workable. Sometimes she needed more help. And I'm going to tell you both when she did it on her own, how she worked with it, and also when we worked together. And when she'd work on her own, she would, her practice, she made a real intention that, you know, her version of the body of fear, which for her was that she would start obsessively rehearsing what she was going to say to him. And obsessively rehearsing or kind of reviewing all how wrong he was. That was her kind of, that let her know that she was entering into the body of fear. Then she would feel in her body how her heart, and the way her heart would feel wasn't, was kind of numb and tight. It wasn't that, you know, it wasn't a real unpleasant feeling, but when she spent some time with it, it became more unpleasant. So she would notice the mind obsessing and rehearsing and blaming, and then her practice, that's R for the rain, and then except she got into the habit of saying, yes, okay, yes, this is here, okay, I'll be with this. And then she would start breathing into her body. Okay. And this is where we start investigating, where we start really contacting and saying, what's here? And as she'd breathe into her body, kind of let go of the blaming and the rehearsing, it would get more painful and more unpleasant. So she'd have to kind of say yes in a deeper way, like, okay, I'll be with this. I'll be with this. And she tried some of the mantras we sometimes talk about here, which is, it's like this. And she'd say it very gently. Okay, it's just like this right now. It's okay. So she was, in a sense, sending a message to this vulnerable place in her that it was seen and it was okay that it was there. And that was her practice. And what she'd find is that there were times that if she just did that very patiently, it would, there'd still be fear in her body, but her sense of who she was became bigger. She felt like she was kind of sitting in her own wisdom and her own courage, because she had the courage to stay. And that gave her more kind of more freedom and flexibility in relating with her husband. There were also times that she felt, there was especially one season where she started really making more connections with what had happened in her childhood. And so she came to a retreat, and we did, in a couple of interviews, we worked with the fear in a way. I want to just let you know about another level of working with it. So she came in, and at this point it wasn't just a mental rehearsing. She felt really gripped by kind of like, she felt like this iron kind of wire around her heart that was squeezing and aching. And when she tried to say yes, she was using the word yes, but everything in her was saying, it's too much, I can't be with this. So that was the beginning. So then she had to recognize that. And what was missing you know, with the allowing piece, there's the recognize and allow, was there wasn't enough space. It's like her contraction into the trance of fear was so tight, there was not enough space to agree to be with it. Okay. That is a flag that we need to find or access some more space and some more heart for the allowing. The allowing piece in rain has to do with the quality of openness and heart. And sometimes, because the fear is so strong, it's not there, and we have to intentionally cultivate the A in rain to let the investigation go deeper. So what we did with her was I had her imagine that she was sitting next to the fear. In other words, take a little bit of space, and that she was on a park bench and the fear was sitting next to her, and just to become aware of her surroundings. And where we were, she could hear birds, so I had her sense the sky and the birds and the breeze, and so that there was more space there. And then I had her let me know whoever in her life helped her feel a sense of love and belonging and safety. And there were just a few people she mentioned. One was a grandmother who was no longer alive, and there was one friend. And then she said, right now you, because you're right here. So I had her sense that these allies were also in the kind of surrounding her and holding her, which created more warmth and more space. And then she put her hand on her heart, and rather than sitting next to the fear, sensed it inside her, but that all that space and warmth and love from all of us was coming through her hand to send a message to her heart, yes, it's okay. This time she could do it. See, at first she was so in the trance of a separate threatened self, there wasn't room to say yes to the fear. It would have been re-traumatizing. We can't always say yes to the fear. There might not be enough sense of resilience. But that gave her enough of a feeling of love and space that she could then start saying yes to it. And that's when she could start investigating it more and feeling the squeezing and the aching and all the kind of pressure in her chest that was for her what fear felt like. And so she kept asking that question, what is happening? And let me be with this. What is happening? Let me be with this. And what happened was the fear turned into huge grieving. And the grieving, although initially it was about her husband, it was really about never having a father that was really a father. That was the grief. And when she could open to that, there was this huge space of tenderness. Huge space of tenderness. And then the fear and the grief were just currents in her ocean. When you can remember you're the ocean, you're not afraid of the waves. This was, she had entered the naturalness, the vastness of her awareness. So this is how rain works. We recognize, we allow, and then we go deeper and deeper into recognizing and allowing until we become that space of clear seeing and caring, which is, it's no longer personal, what's happening. There's a kind of freedom to it. Now, I want to just mention that it's not necessarily something we do alone. And the reason I shared this particular description of working with fear is because a part of taking refuge is taking refuge in the relational field. And it's not something that makes us weak, like we should be able to deal with the fear alone. What we're doing is taking refuge in the truth of belonging. We're taking refuge in the truth that we're not a separate self. And even when we're not majorly traumatized, any moment that we begin to reflect on people we love, people that love us, a sense of what we belong to, we find a kind of warmth and a space so that we can then work more skillfully with the fear. I love this about a mother wrote about her children. She said, after a vigorous brotherly and sisterly disagreement, our three children retired to be aroused at 2 a.m. by a terrific thunderstorm. Hearing an unusual noise upstairs, I called to find out what was going on. A little voice answered, We're in the closet forgiving each other. One of my favorite teachings of the Buddha is that our fear is great, but greater yet is the truth of our connectedness. Our fear is great, but greater yet is the truth of our connectedness. So when we practice this rain, this bringing these two wings to where the fear is, the ring of seeing what's true, and then the heart, remembering our connectedness is what allows us to truly stay and be present with the fear. I always talk about the Dalai Lama, this one story where a very frightened man came and talked to him about what meditations he should do for his fear. And the Dalai Lama's response was so clean. He said, "Don't worry about all those meditations." He said, "Just let yourself be held in the heart of the Buddha." Now, what does that mean? I mean, for the woman that I was working with at that retreat, the heart of the Buddha was she accessed by remembering the people that she felt safety and love with. And in that, and holding with care the fear, she discovered herself in the heart of the Buddha, which is our own awakened heart. For myself, as I've mentioned to a number of you here, in being so sick and meeting a lot of fear in the last few weeks, running into the fear over and over again of, oh my gosh, I'm going to lose my capacity to do things I love. What gave me the space so often to be with that and wake up in the midst of that was just feeling love. I mean, feeling so held by so many here and my family and friends. Just that belonging is such healing for the fear. This is a poem that I really love. It was actually a poem that was very loved by a friend that died who found so much peace in his dying process by remembering the field of belonging. It's called Late Fragment. And did you get what you wanted from this life, even so? I did. And what did you want? To call myself beloved, to feel myself beloved on the earth. So this is the pathway of learning to stay with what can feel like too much. That we begin to recognize it, what's happening, and then offer a kind of space and care. And sometimes we have to cultivate that space and care. For some, it's like gently holding a child within us, just the hand on the heart, breathing with and saying, "I care about this suffering." Or Thich Nhat Hanh says, "Darling, I care about this suffering." Can begin to access that space and warmth. For some, nature. Just going out and leaning against a tree or listening to the sounds of the river. This is a poem by Wendell Berry that I love. When despair for the world grows in me and I wake in the night at the least sound in fear of what my life and my children's lives might be, I go down and lie where the wood drake rests in his beauty in the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come in the presence of silent water and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time I rest in the grace of the world and I am free. There is an awakening that is possible when we, instead of our habits of false refuge, begin to stay and begin to be with the angst, the rawness, the fears that arise. There's a very profound awakening. That's when I describe rain, this way of paying attention. What's really going on is that if instead of our habitual ways of responding to fear, which end up reifying a sense of a threatened self, in the moments that we truly stay, we connect with the space and the awareness in the heart that is our true nature. And when we stay just a little, we touch it a little, and that gives us a little more confidence. Oh, okay, I can be with this. Every time, instead of the flinch response to judge or run or eat, we just pause, like the Buddha did under the Bodhi tree. We just pause and breathe and touch in a little. We are giving ourselves that gift of waking up out of the trance. This is really the potential in the moments of learning to stay. Rumi writes of night travelers who search the darkness instead of running away from it. A companionship of people willing to know their own fear, that realize in the tenderness of the pain, they discover their awakened heart. You know how Rumi says, don't turn away. Keep your gaze on the bandage place. That's where the light enters you. So there's an alchemy that happens. That when we open to the hugeness of fear, we become an openness. When we meet fear with love, the very tenderness of that love takes us home into really our loving awareness as our nature. There's a tremendous courage that grows from that. I've said a number of times, if you know you're the ocean, if you realize yourself as that awareness, if you realize your belonging, then there's a real courage that gives room for whatever could happen. And so many times the Buddha said, the happiness we seek is not hitched to any of the things we normally think. It's the happiness that comes when we realize we can be with whatever goes on. That we have the power of heart and awareness to be with whatever arises. I'll give you share just a story that I heard from Spirit Rock. A woman described working as a volunteer at a hospital. And she got to know a little girl named Liz who was suffering from a rare and a serious disease. And her only chance of recovery appeared to be a blood transfusion from her 5-year-old brother, who had miraculously survived the same disease and had developed the antibodies that were needed to combat it. So the doctor explained the situation to her little brother and asked the little boy if he'd be willing to give his blood to his sister. And this is the woman's writing, says, I saw him hesitate for only a moment before taking a deep breath and saying, yes, I'll do it if it will save her. As the transfusion progressed, he lay in bed next to his sister and smiled, as we all did, seeing the color returning to her cheeks. Then his face grew pale and his smile faded. He looked up at the doctor and asked him with a trembling voice, will I start to die right away? Being young, the little boy had misunderstood the doctor. He thought he was going to have to give his sister all of his blood in order to save her. So I wanted to tell you that because that really, when I heard that, it really touched me because I realized it's not so unusual. In some deep way, when we feel our belonging, we hold this life without so much clinging and grasping. There's a kind of inner freedom that is possible if we really trust we're the ocean, if we really trust the love that's here. It is a true refuge. So this practice, and it's a daily practice, because fear is in our nervous system. You know, if you really stop at any given moment and say, okay, what's going on? There is a sense of tightness that comes with any story of a self that's on their way somewhere. It's in there. So it's an ongoing practice. And the invitation is to pause and to bring these two wings that really deepen to become that rain that lets the spore become the blossom, to really that spiritual reparenting. What is happening that we ask the parts of ourselves that are afraid? And can we meet this with care? Can we meet this with care? When we meet our fear with care, when we realize the awareness that holds it, Rilke puts it this way. He says, we, in this radiant and changeless awareness, can contain death, the whole of death, can hold it in one's heart gentle and not refuse to go on living. So I wanted to close with that by meeting fear, it actually frees us to live. And that the pain and grief we have about not living fully is because we've been in a trance. In the moments we learn to meet the fear, we're actually embracing our life. So I think that's enough words for tonight. Let me just invite you to pause and let's just sit together for a few moments. In these last few moments, just sensing what's happening inside you. And it might be calm, it might be anxious inside you, uncomfortable, happy. Just to recognize and allow. Recognize and allow with a deep quality of kindness. May all beings be held in loving kindness, be filled with loving kindness. And may all beings rest in natural and great peace. May all beings realize the awareness, the love that is their true nature. May all awaken and be free. Namaste.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.